I'm Dorothy Wickenden. On today's Politics and More podcast, two perspectives on the Democratic National Convention. First, Andy Borowitz, the creator of the Borowitz Report, discusses the pageantry. Then David Remnick talks with New Yorker staff writer Jelani Cobb about what the convention tells us about how the Democratic Party has changed during the Obama presidency.
As all the lunacy of the back-to-back convention weeks finally ratcheted down, I called up a man uniquely qualified to deal with these events. My friend, my colleague, Andy Borowitz. He writes the Borowitz Report for The New Yorker.
So, Andy, kind of a transition from one week to the next. We've gone from Blade Runner convention to what?
Well, it's the Hillary convention. And the biggest challenge of nominating Hillary Clinton is that you have as the star of the show, Hillary Clinton. And she, to take a direct quote from her, she says, "I'm not a natural politician," which sort of makes you question her choice of career in a way, because like I am not a natural, harmonica player. And so I've like avoided jobs that require harmonica skills. I think the DNC and the way they've staged this, they've borrowed a strategy that was used a lot in music videos in the 80s. Like if you had the star of the show was somebody like Phil Collins or Steve Winwood who could not really move or dance, you would just surround them with lots of great dancers and bodies flying through the frame. And that's basically what they've done in this convention. You've got like Bill and Joe and Michelle and Barack and weird old Mike Bloomberg. And they've really distracted attention away from the fact that the star of the show is Hillary.
Mike Bloomberg was a little weird, wasn't he?
He is by far my favorite thing about this convention.
Do tell.
He kind of helicoptered in from the planet Bloomberg. He got down there and basically said, "Donald Trump is not a real billionaire. I'm a real billionaire. He sucks." And then he got out. Like, he just flew away. And it's like, what was that?
Do you think it sealed the billionaire vote?
Well, I think just people love to observe billionaire on billionaire violence. It's so rare to see it. And I think that people enjoyed it. They just enjoyed it.
Hot billionaire on billionaire violence.
That's right.
The one thing I could not have imagined for the world of me was the fact that you'd have a James Bond plot. Going that there's a Russian element, a Putin-Trump bromance.
Yeah, a little bit Tom Clancy was good. Now, I wanted to talk to you about that because you're sort of a Russian hand. I know you've written at least one book on Russia. I have Googled Russia, so we're coming at it from slightly different angles. But I wanted to get your take. Obviously, Putin is very much his hand, is very much of the levers of power here. But do you feel like he's trying to help the Republicans or help the Democrats? Do you have any hot take on that?
Oh, I think Putin is much happier with the idea of a Trump presidency. First of all, he resents the United States enormously.
Right.
It resents it fantastically. You know, thinks of the 90s as a great humiliation in which we were laughing at drunk Boris Yeltsin, and now we're telling him not to go into Ukraine, which is in his sphere of influence. They hate Hillary Clinton.
Right.
They hate the Clintons because the Clintons were in power during the 90s when everything was going south for Russia. It was chaotic and was humiliating in world affairs and at home. And now Hillary Clinton is on the edge of the White House. He doesn't want to see that. He wants to see the United States as destabilized and as distracted and crazy as possible.
Well, I thought you might say that because I've also Googled you. But I think it's questionable because I think everything Putin did this week really helped the Democrats.
You know, last week we described the Republican convention as dystopic and bleak and fear-mongering and all the rest. And I think we were joined by the entire commentariat in that. And his numbers went way up. And his poll numbers in some areas have passed Hillary Clinton. And there's a kind of general freak out among the Democrats. Do you think that Hillary will regain ground in the polls because of the smoothness of the week, the relative smoothness of the week?
It was kind of a love-in. It was sort of a love convention. And it was also a convention where when somebody did something incredibly cheesy and sentimental and you said, "Oh my God, they're not going to do that. That's never going to work," it somehow did work. I mean, I sort of came away believing in the audacity of cheese because I think, like, especially we have to talk about Bill Clinton. I mean, Bill Clinton, when he said, you know, 40 years ago, I met a girl. And he was like, oh, my God, he's actually going to.
Oh, no, no, it was worse than that. It was worse than that. He starts talking, and then I tapped her on the shoulder. And you're going to get his seduction technique. And you just thought, oh, my God, I know I'm not the only one thinking this. Don't go down this route. I don't want to hear how you picked up girls.
No, it was and just was like walking in on your parents having sex. I mean, you know they do. You just didn't want to hear the details. And he went on and tried to make it seem like Bill and Hillary were one of the greatest love stories of all time. And I was hearing, I was saying, are people buying this? And sure enough, you know, that night on social media, I saw so many Democrats were just completely in love with it. So that did show the power of cheese. I mean, it does
also
work.
The power of what you want to hear. I mean, I have no problem with people having a complex marriage. God knows marriage is complex, and theirs is just famously so. And people who are going to watch the Republican convention and want Trump to do well are going to see it far differently than the opposite. But I just thought that speech, you know, starting off, I met a girl, and it was something very old-fashioned and not a good way, the way it started off. But then it kicked into really high gear and talked about the depth of her accomplishments and what she's cared about.
That was good. It was good. Although the one thing I would say about, you know, these conventions are all about the reinvention of the candidate. And basically the message of these conventions tends to be whatever you thought about the candidate going in, the exact opposite is actually true. And so like last week we heard and we talked about it, famously misogynistic Donald Trump is actually America's foremost feminist. We learned that.
And from his daughter, we heard that.
Exactly. But this week, the message seemed to be from speaker after speaker, you think that Hillary Clinton has been a single-minded careerist her entire life, and actually, she spends most of her time visiting people in hospitals. That's really how she spends most of it. It's like 90% hospital visits, 10% career.
Andy, thank you, and will you promise to be with us on the nights of the debates? Because those are not to be missed.
Absolutely. And I assume we're going to be doing the same thing when Jill Stein is nominated for the Green Party, because that's going to be amazing.
Maybe at less length. Andy, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Andy Borowitz writes the Borowitz Report, and you can find it at newyorker.com.
And now the interview with Jelani and David.
Shortly after President Obama spoke, I got in touch with Jelani Cobb, a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's the author of The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress, which was published not long after Obama's election. Jelani also recently hosted a PBS Frontline special on race and policing, which is a terrific look at these issues. Jelani, you were at the 2008 convention for the Democrats, and now you've spent the week in Philadelphia. With President Obama doing everything he can to pass the baton to his old rival and Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and yet, throughout the convention, to say nothing of the last 8 years, race has been a dominant theme. And I wanted you to step back and give us an assessment about how you feel about the president's handling of race as a subject in the broadest sense, the way you were feeling about it in your book, The Substance of Hope, and the way you're feeling it now as he's facing his last months in office.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, you know, in Denver in 2008, when Obama was being nominated, and I was a delegate at that point, and even among the delegates who were certain that he was about to be nominated, there was still this sense of disbelief. And of course, there was like this bigger sense of disbelief among virtually everyone in the country that this was about to happen. And at the same time, there was this kind of question about whether or not people were going to take this as the automatic inoculation against any concerns or problems related to race in the United States. And at the end of that speech, these confetti cannons went off, and everyone down the row jumped. And it wasn't because we were startled by the cannons. I think there was this real sense of concern for his safety, that even as he was talking about having kind of eclipsed one barrier in American history, people were worried about, quite frankly, his safety and his life, given the history of black leaders in this country and assassination. And so I think that in some ways we've kind of steered between those two shoals in the ensuing years. We've seen kind of point after point after point after point in which race has emerged and been a dominant part of the conversation here, maybe not in ways that we anticipated. I don't think that people expected to see the kind of explosive, highly contentious situations that have involved, for the most part, firearms that have been a dominant theme in his presidency. And so here in Philadelphia, people have tried to very delicately touch upon that. And so when you saw the mothers of the movement, for instance, the women who had lost children to gun violence in situations, for the most part, to gun violence, in situations that had serious racial implications, very often with policing, they were preceded by a police officer, and they were preceded by Eric Holder. And of course, it makes sense if you're trying to, if you're a Democratic Party and you're looking to say that you're trying to peel off people from the middle and independents and people who may not quite agree with the Black Lives Matter movement. And so they've been trying to strike that balance kind of time and time again in everything you've seen here.
Do you think there's any space between Obama and Clinton when it comes to Black Lives Matter? Both Clintons have struggled with Black Lives Matter in, to some degree in terms of rhetoric and approach in their meetings with them. You've seen protests and so on.
Well, I mean, I think there's certainly a space in terms of credibility. You know, Barack Obama comes to this as, one, a Black person, and then also someone who does have that activist background as a young person in the South Side of Chicago. And if you recall, kind of in the midpoint of the primaries, when Bill Clinton had that blow-up at the protesters from Black Lives Matter, and you know, he would kind of went in and defended the 1994 crime bill, and then people thought this was a disaster because African-American voters were supposed to be the firewall that was going to prevent the nomination from being snatched away by Bernie Sanders. And so the next day or a couple days after that, you see Bill Clinton have to kind of walk that back a little bit. And then, of course, Hillary Clinton has been criticized by that movement as well for some of the rhetoric from the 1990s, the super predator references, and so on.
So you've been at these different conventions. What struck you the most in Philadelphia? You saw a party that was not exactly unified, especially outside the arena, but sometimes in the arena as well.
Well, you know, what was interesting is that these two conventions are kind of almost like bookends or mirror images of each other, because in 2008, there was this great deal of fear about the party being divided between Hillary Clinton's people and Barack Obama's people and whether or not that lack of unity would be fatal. As a matter of fact, in talking to the Georgia delegation, former President Jimmy Carter said, well, you know, I'm an expert on what divided conventions do. And said, you know, as you saw in 1976, the Republicans were divided and I won. And he said, then 1980, the Democratic Party was largely divided and they won. And this was a real kind of concern that was floating around among people that turned out to be, for the most part, unfounded. And by the end of the convention, especially after Hillary Clinton gave that kind of barn-burning speech that she gave, which I think has been underrated in the number of speeches and that Hillary Clinton has given, after she gave that speech, you saw the party really come together. And in Philadelphia, it's been the opposite. The delegates seem to be much more skeptical here. And so after the formal nomination of Hillary Clinton, about 300 people or so bolted from the hall. And, you know, many of these were people who were chanting, Bernie, 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 and kind of marched over to the media tent and, you know, had a spontaneous sit-in in the media tent, protesting the way that they, in their terms, had been silenced by the Democratic Party. And last night I went to a meeting of the Green Party that the Green Party held across town from the convention. And there was a serious conversation, even more contentious conversation than you might imagine.
How many people were there?
This was about maybe 300 or 400 people. This building was packed. And they were debating whether or not Bernie Sanders should be considered a sellout for having given his endorsement to Hillary Clinton.
And yet they're facing, in the arguments of the majority of the delegates are there and the Democratic constituency, they are facing ultimately a binary choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in the real existing world.
Well, I think that, you know, what's interesting is when you talk with these people, they kind of reject the binary. And so Jill Stein has this phrase that she uses that it's time to reject the lesser of two evils for the greater good.
Even if that means electing Donald Trump.
Well, I think there's a kind of cause and effect disjuncture here, where I think a lot of people who are, you know, liberals or maybe independents would see that as being the case. But in those circles, there is not that kind of assumption that those two things are connected. Jill Stein said yesterday in this meeting, she said, we're choosing between the lesser of two evils, and it's debatable which is the lesser. And one of the other things I think that's been probably the case with Hillary is that having been in public life for decades, it's telling that the super predator line that she made was not fatal to her at the time. And the great deal of controversy that she's encountered has been 20 years later, when we have a very different set of attitudes about it, and not coincidentally, a much lower crime rate than we had in 1995, 1996.
One of the interesting speeches came from Jesse Jackson, who didn't quite have the primetime spot that he had in previous years, but he was no less interesting, and he said that Hillary does understand that Black Lives Matter, and said that she would stand up against the NRA and stand up to the Washington gun lobby and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And it's not quite clear how she would go about doing that. I'd love to know your take on that, your view of what Hillary Clinton really can, in the real existing world, do when it comes to guns that Barack Obama could not.
I'm not sure what any American politician is going to do or able to do to break, you know, the logjam that we have right now. But I do think that one of the things that, you know, that happens, it was not, I think, coincidental that Michael Bloomberg was here to speak, not simply as someone who is appealing to independence and, you know, a businessman and so on, but also someone who's had this kind of very vocal presence about the issues around guns in American society. And I think guns are the way of finessing these complexities between wanting to appeal to people who think about Black Lives Matter as important and wanting to appeal to people who think that the safety and protection of police officers is paramount. And the common denominator between those two things is guns.
Jelani, have a safe trip home from Philadelphia. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
That was David Remnick talking with Andy Borowitz and Jelani Cobb.